Well, good afternoon, everybody. We'll go ahead and get started now. Thank you for attending session number 152, titled Love and Gender Equality at Home, a Model of Family Transformation. Before we begin, I'd like to ask that all your cell phones and other electronic sounding devices are turned off, and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue, so please keep that in mind while engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be invited to enjoy the rest of the session on audio tape at home. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years now of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books, and consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and our presenter to keep within the framework of time so we can allow for the next session to start on time as well. As a courtesy to others and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presenters can begin preparation for the next session. Our presenter this afternoon is Julie de Azevedo Hanks, a PhD and a master's in licensed clinical social work. Oh, no, that's the credential, isn't it?
Yeah, okay.
She is a seasoned psychotherapist, owner of Wasatch Family Therapy, author of The Burnout Cure and The Assertiveness Guide for Women. She's a media contributor, performing songwriter and blogger about Mormon culture and emotional health. With that introduction, we'll turn the time over to Julie.
I'm sure my clicker's working here. You know, I may take that wireless mic. I'm a performer, and so like to stand here for 90 minutes makes me cringe. No cringing allowed. Okay, thank you. And since, yeah, I'm going to, oh, much better. Hi. Okay, I like this. Thank you, first of all, for being here. I know you have several interesting options, so I appreciate you choosing this one. I'm really passionate about this topic of gender equality in Mormonism. And the model of family transformation that I'll be sharing is part of my dissertation study. And my topic was supporting creative productivity of mothers. So how can we do that? And I got into the literature and kind of, for my lit review, did what are the barriers individually, familially, and societally for creative women. So I outlined those. And right at the end of my lit review process, I came across an article that introduced me to cultural transformation theory and how it relates to creativity. But what it did was open up all new ways of thinking, a new lens that has been really helpful for me in navigating my Mormonism, and also I think provides a path for us to work towards more partnership between the sexes. Okay, so just an overview. So this is Rhian Eisler's work. She's author of The Chalice and the Blade, The Real Wealth of Nations. And she's a metahistorian and looked at history and prehistory with her feminine perspective. And what she saw is that societies organize toward one or the other end of a spectrum. And on one end is a dominator model. And the fundamental way that a dominator society is organized is by ranking. Ranking. Who's on top? It is led by a hierarchy of domination through fear and force. There's a high degree of institutionalized violence. Anything related to men and masculinity is highly valued, and anything related to femininity and softer values and caretaking is devalued. So that's on one end, the dominator model. On the partnership model, it's organized by linking or connecting, not ranking. And as I realized this lens, I thought, the ranking is everywhere. How can we move toward connecting? How we're connected instead of who's on top? Organized by hierarchies of actualization. So in partnership societies, it's not like kumbaya, there's nobody in charge. There are structures, and their responsibility is to actualize and lift the entire group, not to keep everybody else down. So that's just a quick overview. We'll be going into that. Oh, masculine and femininity are equally valued, and caring and nonviolence are valued by men and women. And this caring is a really important part. In partnership model societies, men and women participate in caregiving. Men and women participate in leadership in all areas of society. So I use the ladder just as a shorthand for the dominator model. So I can ask myself, wait, am I on the ladder or am I on the field? The ladder or the field? So in my study of cultural transformation theory and the partnership model, what I've come to understand is that she's talking about Zion cultures. Here's some scriptural passages that point to that. In 4th Nephi, and it came to pass there was no contention in the land because of the love of God, which did dwell in the hearts of the people. And there were no envyings, nor strife, nor tumults, no whoredoms. There could not have been a happier people. Mosiah 7:24, that every man should esteem his neighbor as himself, laboring with their own hands. In Alma 1:30, they did not send away those who were naked or hungry or athirst. They did not set their heart upon riches. Therefore, they were liberal to all, both old and young, bond and free, male and female, having no respect to persons as to who stood in need. And then DNC 121:41, no power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness. So partnership is, this partnership model can provide a path for us to create gender equality and to actualize Zion. Domination is pride. It's ranking, organized by ranking. 2 Nephi 28, 24 through 26, they were lifted up in pride, wearing costly apparel. Their substance was no more common among them, divided into classes. So the ranking always creeps in. There's once they're lifted up in the pride of their hearts. Alma 4:15, the afflictions of the humble followers of God and persecutions were heaped upon them. So we have some really strong scriptural basis to go, wait, what she's describing is periods of peace in the scriptures, and my concept of what Zion is. So, where do you think our culture falls on the dominator partnership continuum? And no society is all one or all the other. We all have elements. Dominator, yeah. So we inherited this paradigm, this way of viewing the world that we rarely question and we think is normal. Like, that's just how people are. People just, you know, want to be on top. Well, according to Eisler's theory, that is not true. And according to the scriptures, that's not true. We have the capacity to connect, to love, to be caring, to share, to be linked, connected. And we have the potential to dominate and be violent through fear and force. So an example of a partnership culture that I think is really fascinating and kind of gives me a vision of a clear vision of Zion, because this society existed. Around the turn of the 20th century, archaeologists discovered Minoan Crete, this highly advanced civilization that they hadn't known about before. And it was really interesting because I believe it was 4,000 BCE to 200... or to 2000, but it was during a time when a lot of the other corresponding cultures were dominator model, and this was partnership. So this was the exception. But through the archaeological findings, they found that the goddess was visible in art and in religion. There were no signs of war. There were no paint. You know, they didn't find any evidence of violence. Female figures were, like statues were found that seemed to be raising their hands, giving blessings, or holding, that's supposed to be serpents, and other god and goddess symbols. Men and women appear to have lived joyfully together. This is big. They viewed power as responsibility. So it wasn't power over, but power to. Power to lift. Power, this is really interesting. Power was equated, from what they can tell, with the responsibility of motherhood, rather than obedience to male elite through fear and force. They couldn't find any evidence that there was a very poor underclass. It seemed to be, fairly equitable. Very technologically advanced. There was evidence of irrigation, paved roads, sanitation. And women appear to have held high status in every part of society. Wealth of the society was used to improve the conditions for all, which I think is really powerful. And there was an integration of religion, entertainment. There was a merging. Religion was integrated into all parts of life. As this civilization grew, as it became more complex, the value and status of women did not decrease like it did in other corresponding cultures. Now, I think this one is interesting, given our modesty, conversations. Bare-chested women, skimpy male clothing that emphasized genitals, just showed a frank appreciation for differences and the pleasure made possible by those sexual differences. Isn't that interesting? And her and Eisler's theory and some other archaeologists think that because they were healthy sexually, that was part of the decreased violence, which I thought was fascinating. So I love this because it gives us an actual model, right? So you can talk about partnership in abstract, but just go, wow, people actually created this? How do we do this? So back to my dissertation, I stumbled on this theory, and I realized that all of the literature that I was reviewing was all filtered through a dominator lens, right? Even how we describe what is creative is based on a masculine model of the most, the best, right? That's how we define what's creative. It's not about what's useful or what's connecting. And so I realized, oh my goodness, like this is everywhere. And so what I realized is that a partnership model in family life would address all of the barriers to creative productivity of mothers that I had outlined in the lit review. Every single one of them would not exist if families were organized based on this partnership model. And so I did some case studies, exemplifications, and different things to illustrate that. And there was a turning point. I was going to quit my PhD. I don't know if any of you have had that feeling. I was like, I'm done. I can't do this. My husband had lost his job. I was supporting our family full-time at that point. It was, like, too much. And then I realized, if I view my dissertation as a creative product, I want to quit because I'm facing every single barrier to creative productivity that I just wrote about, except for unsupportive spouse. But everything else, sense of isolation, perfectionism, difficulty integrating with identity integration, no room of my own, right? No, right? I claimed, as part of my dissertation process, I claimed a room in our house. Like, this is mine. You're sharing rooms or you're moving out. Like, because you know what? We are all equally valuable and my creativity matters. And so it's, isn't it, my mom's here, isn't it a great room? It's vibrant. And then a partnership model in family life and raising families that take this model of existing into the culture addresses all the constraints in society, the limited access to resources, the fact that men tend to be the gatekeepers in different fields, on and on. So it was such an exciting thing that I was going to quit, and I had one of those like rare like pillar of light epiphanies. You know those, like they're rare. And I realized, as I figure out how to write my dissertation, I will be creating the model that I'm writing about in my dissertation. Are you with me? And as I figure out how to organize a family in a partnership way, I'm helping myself finish the dissertation. It was like, oh, I can do this. I can do this. I got really excited about it. So I did finish. I graduated. That was pretty cool. And then I realized, wow, this model that I created for families based on the partnership model is just a really great model of family life. I happened to stumble upon this theory through studying women's creative productivity, but the model can exist separate from that. So that's what I want to share with you today. So it's called the Partnership Model of Family Organization. As a microcosm of society, the family can act as a crucible for the creation of partnership. It seems the most obvious place to start with the people we love most and are closest to. Okay, so there's 8 C's. I'm a songwriter and a writer, so I like alliteration. And so the first one is cooperative adult leadership. And this is basically, there's everyone's on the plane, on the field, okay? And the relationships are egalitarian. No one is telling, you know, no adult is telling another adult what to do and how to do it. That there's a partnership that's modeled in family life. And then the parent or parents are seen as the actualization hierarchy. So our job as parents is to help everyone actualize. And a lot of what has happened in Mormonism and a broader culture is that women's needs have been ranked below the needs of other people, and then we have idealized suffering and, you know, being a martyr, and that's ranking, right? Well, she gave everything she had, so her, you know, why? That's how one of my sisters and I, we say motherhood without suffering. So, like, anything we can do to, like, mother without suffering, we're going to do it. Not to make it easier, not harder. And then, so there's mutual decision-making, right? If there's not agreement, there's no moving forward on something. And authoritative parenting style. So as adults interact with kids, it's not through domination, fear, and force, or shame, which is emotional force. It's through authoritative parenting style, which balances guidance, structure, with autonomy, this connection between the parent and child. It's not about conformity, it's about the connection. So that is cooperative adult leadership. And I am pleased that we're seeing the word partnership in relation to marriage a lot more lately. I'm still trying to figure out what men preside and men and women are in equal partnership actually means. Like, what's the truth? Because I look for this nugget of truth in something that's like, I don't get that. But we're hearing partnership. We're hearing equal. We're hearing those words, which matter. Words create. Here's just a couple of examples. Marriage requires a full partnership where wives and husbands work side by side to meet the needs of the family. Amen. I can get behind that. A marriage of equal partners is also one in which partners help one another in their stewardships. Indeed, are obligated to help one another as equal partners. This partnership extends to housework and childcare. President Packer has said there is no task, however menial, connected with the care of babies, the nurturing of children, or with the maintenance of the home that is not the husband's equal obligation. So we get some mixed messages, right? Like, women are nurturers, men are presiders and providers. And yet we're hearing more about a partnership philosophy, which I am very encouraged by. So are there any questions about this first cooperative leadership? Can you see how this might transform, like if a child from birth on grew up seeing this modeled, how that would change the expectations of themselves and their lives? Yeah? So the second is connection orientation. So instead of who's in charge, who's the boss, because I said so, you know, fear, force, the family is organized around creating secure attachments. So that's an emotional bond. So often we look and evaluate parenting based on behavior, what people can see. You know, we go, oh, well, all of my kids got married in the temple. So it's behavioral, right? None of them speak to me, and I don't really know who they are, but, right? So we don't talk about the quality of the connection. And from an attachment theory lens, that is the thing that matters. That is the thing in life. If you're connected in a meaningful way to another human being, You can get through anything. If you're disconnected, we wither and die. I mean, we literally need connection for our physical survival. And so secure attachment. So there's, you know, the mom guilt, because like Mormon moms especially are supposed to be so perfect at everything. But if you think about creating secure attachments, and this is men and women, because I believe in parents taking care of their children, that, excuse me, I lost my train of thought. Oh, that you only have to be emotionally attuned 30% of the time to create a secure attachment. Like, we think it has to be 99.9% of the time. So I hold on to that. Like, I can do 30%. Yes, 30%. So this secure attachments aren't about doing. They're about being. They're about that connection that's invisible, that we don't really have language to talk about very well in our culture. We talk a lot about the visible works and things that you can see. But secure attachment, if a child or adult has a secure attachment, we can get through any kind of hardship or heartache. With connection orientation, it's process oriented. So we kind of talked a little bit about this. We focus so much on results, the statistics, like what's your percentage of visiting your home teaching? What's your, right? Like, because we think if you can measure something, it's more important. But connection or process oriented is recognizing that everything is a process that's co-created, right? So every relationship is not a line of interaction, but a circle that's recursive and it's co-created. So the process that a child or an adult is going through, like what's going on with them emotionally, what are they thinking about, is highly valued, not just what they're doing, what are your grades, you know, those, how come you didn't, aren't the star of the lacrosse team. It's about what the process is going on within them. And then in connection orientation, there's also an awareness and acknowledgement of the interconnection. So we tend to think in terms of individualism, like the individual is we're separate. And then now we talk about the family as the basic unit a lot in Mormonism. And that hasn't always been the case. I mean, family meant extended family. It meant aunts, uncles. It meant cousins. It meant neighbors. And so we have this idea in our current discourse that a family is just this little unit, but it's not. We're all interconnected with our community, with our, you know, with the earth. And so acknowledging that interconnection and the impact of our behavior and how we treat other people and how we treat nature. So in this model, as I was developing this, I came to understand that motherhood and parenting, it's a relationship, it's an emotional bond with another human being, it's not a role or list of socially prescribed behaviors. And if you think about it as a relationship, that points to the interconnection. Parenting is a relationship with a person. And we don't often talk, we talk about role, we talk about, it's a relationship. That's what all parents have in common, is that they have a bond with their child. Okay, the third C is caretaking emphasis. So caring for others is highly valued. All family members participate in caring for each other. In Mormon culture, there's little room or there's little overt examples of women asking their children for support or asking their husband for support that's not financial, right? Like, with the ranking, a lot of times women's needs get lowered. But in a partnership family, everyone participates in caring for each other. So this week this is my third presentation. So I have been up many late nights, and I've required my kids to support me. Right? You know, we can't talk about new school clothes until next week. This is my boundary. Like, I'm doing something that's important to me, you're important to me too, and I need your support. And that's okay. To have that be a family issue and not a woman's issue, to take care of everyone and everything. Any questions about this?
This is nice
because it extends to
other generations as well. And one person in the family would not be
necessarily
stuck with the caring for the parents.
Right. And society would also, like, as a collective, we would value caregiving. And that's when the brethren emphasize motherhood, I reinterpret it in my brain to say, caring for other people is really, really important. They're trying to elevate the value of caring. But my concern is that if it's always pushed on as a woman's responsibility, in a dominator model, it will continue to be devalued. Right? Because in a dominator model, things associated with men are more highly valued. So if we keep it, caring is this thing over here that nurturing, that only women do, it will continue to be less valuable. Yes?
That doesn't make any sense. You know, with your scripture on priesthood, is meekness,
long-suffering? Yeah. Yeah, love, patience. Right.
I mean, those are...
Right.
So I'm just wondering how they don't get it.
So this lens has really helped me because it's men and women against a dominator model of society, right? We've all inherited this lens, so power means power over. That means control. Right? It doesn't mean nurturing. We didn't go power, you know, motherhood. You don't think that in our idea of power, right? So we're all victimized by this dominator model that straitjackets men into, like, that isn't masculine, right? But and so they're missing out on that, right? We don't often hear in conference the importance of fathers having a secure attachment with their child. Right? We talk in terms of roles, duties, responsibilities. Like, if I were a man, I wouldn't like that would feel just as uncomfortable to me as sometimes what I hear spoken about in really prescribed terms for women. So it takes the, like, men against women. No, it's people against a dominator model and moving to partnership. Yeah.
Sense of, you know, should we start from actually as a family using
Yes. Yes, yes, and yes. So my thought on that is we have to hit on every single level. We have to hit families, and I start with families because I'm a therapist. I work with families. But if kids, if a huge group of kids' brains were wired for connection instead of fight or flight and compete, I mean, that would change how everything is run, right? So we can start there. We can also, just as individuals, something that I've tried to do is check myself. Am I on the ladder or am I on the field where everyone is playing a different and equally valuable role? Where am I? And because it's easy in a dominator culture to interact with power and authority in a dominator manner, right? Well, I'll show you. Well, I'll show you who's stronger. I'm going to, you know, force, shame. And so, you know, I don't have a magic answer, but I think we can do that on every level. I think part of it is intervening at social policy level, where we have policies that say we actually care about taking care of other people, right? Lowest paid jobs are ones that directly are direct caregiving of another human being. Those are usually the lowest paid jobs, and that says, you know, I mean, everyone would say, oh, I value, you know, my relationships, or I value, yeah, I think it's really important. Mothers are really important, but, you know, really low pay for caregiving professions. Yeah. No. See, and this is an example of it's like, well, who's on top, right? Okay, well, then if we're valuing women's, then men have to be underneath. It's like we can't even think about it, right? That ranking is just so second nature to us. I think...
But you are saying that we don't want to have the ranking.
Right. Yeah, and redefine what it means to be masculine, right? The Savior taught partnership. Everything he taught is partnership.
But this way, I'm just saying, this makes men, in my experience, very uncomfortable with this idea that suddenly the things that they had valued before are, the new model now is everything they've worked so hard to, like, you know, get up on.
Where's the ladder? Where am I? I need to know my value, because if I'm higher on the ladder, yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And I think it makes everybody uncomfortable. Whenever you redefine. Yeah. Well, are men, are you uncomfortable? Like, are you concerned about? Yeah. Sunstone men are different. Is that what you're saying? No, Gina's husband's different. Yes.
I'm not uncomfortable, but...
but I'm squirming in my chair.
No, not at all. Fantastic. The thing that interests me is that, and I know maybe this will speak a little bit to what you were saying, but in the Christian session of the General Conference, we are getting much more of the don't leave it to your wife. Do the housework and look after the children, they're your children as well, and you need to be partners. The message we're not, but I wonder whether women are here, is you need to be equally responsible for providing the resources to your home,
mm-hmm.
And do the yard work and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They can't,
yeah.
But
Oh, definitely.
Because
women are already doing that.
Yeah.
Nobody's telling them to do it. They're already, you know, participate. They're already participating.
We don't like starvation.
But that, you know, that's a really good point. And so I don't. One comment back on your point is, it's not that we don't value power. It's that we don't value fear and force and domination. To be powerful is to have influence, to do something to actualize yourself and everyone else. We don't think of that, but that can be masculine. That's still powerful. That's still strength. So I think what we're talking about is integrating the masculine and feminine in each person. There's no ACT test for that. You're right. Because right, right. Yeah. And then you're worthless. I mean, really, like, who's going to hire you if you haven't graduated from Harvard? Right? You're just trying to live by them. Yes, in the back.
Mm-hmm. And I think that matters as a result. So what we're really talking about is a very specific definition of masculine. And I just want to add that to the conversation.
Yeah,
and then the
thank you.
To add the other thing. I think instead of saying power, maybe, but because the way we understand power, those
right.
of us that have been abused, it's a life word. So maybe another word to use would be ability.
Yeah, ability, so influence. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Yes. Who's uncomfortable?
I think everyone. Because, like, when I think about, how parents might feel about their children or how even siblings care about one another, I mean, there's a sense of protectiveness about letting others involved in that act, right? That's been influenced. So I'm just interested to see how this model, would actually have to change the way that we integrate.
So what if we don't draw the distinction between public and private? Because our economic system is set up to measure and count the things we value. So literally caregiving, like parenting, does not count as productive work. It literally does not count as doing something that contributes to the economy. We wouldn't have people here, we wouldn't have... Right? So it literally does not count. So that's both a public and a private issue, right? So do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I just wonder
I guess for me there's no distinction. It's all...
Which would have to happen
first,
the difference in perception in that, or do we work on a family
model first? So I come from a more recursive, circular way of thinking about that. There is no first. It's like jump in there and start, you know, perturbating the system. But you know, start making change wherever you can on whatever level you can, right? If you are living a partnership model where you are not competing with anybody for, you know, who's the best, the most, you're teaching your children how to connect, how to create secure attachments, that actually matters more than what your grades are. It's how, you know, how have you treated people today? right? Instead of, well, you know, why'd you get such a bad grade on your test? Like, we can do that wherever we are, and some here are able to have influence immediately in, you know, in the public, you know, political or business or government or whatever. So I say just jump in and start changing it wherever we can. Great questions and comments. Yes.
Figure it out. You tell me if you're going to exercise, if you're going to eat well, if you're going to get enough sleep, and then you solve your own problems, because I'm your mother and I'm a wife, but I'm also a person and I need time for myself too, and I don't need to only get all of the problems. So take your power and you be the person that you need to be so that you can be healthy. Don't dump it on me and wait for me to give you the answer to it.
I love that. Amen. Amen. Yes. Yeah, I think we have moved a long way, and we have a lot of the indicators of domination, like high degree of violence.
Two words, Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is what he said. I think we are moving that way, and we still have a lot of those characteristics, in-group, out-group, us versus them, violence, you know, not valuing caregiving, those kinds of things. So yes, we do, and we have a lot of work to do too. So I'm glad that you're acknowledging the progress, because we definitely have made some movement, at least in American culture, to be more accepting, compassionate, you know, thinking more in terms of systems instead of just us. No, because there's such a high degree of domestic violence, you know, child abuse. Those are all signs of domination model, power over, because those things are about power. Does that make sense? So I think we're making progress, and there's still a lot of evidence of domination. So, but I love hopefulness. That's great. Yes. That's a great question. I mean, nothing immediately comes to mind. Right. We do see examples of that. I guess for me, I choose, like, yes, there is the ladder, But I choose not to see it as like those people in power and us little. It's like we're all in this together. So part of, I think, what the work is education, like educating people that there is another way, and that if relationships really are the most important thing, then this is a better path. Because, you know, I think, what do people care about when they're dying? They care about their attachments. They don't care about stuff. They don't care about power over. They care about relationships. We say that, but then we, in the dominator model, we get all this ranking. So I think there's a lot of educating that needs to be done to go, look, if this is what you want, you know, happiness comes from connection with other human beings. And I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of research to back that up. So that's one way. Yes. I love how you are so nuanced and sensitive, and how I love this. Anyway, go ahead. So, great question. Lots of different parts. I think one way is to see that we all have power too. We all have power too, to make a difference for someone. So, I don't see anyone as 100% powerless. Does that make sense? Because we have choices, and there are times for violence. I mean, really, you know, if someone is kidnapping my child, you know, I'm going to go after them and, you know, just do whatever I can to rescue my child. So it's not that there's no place for force, but in a partnership model, that is the last resort when everything else has been tried and, you know, there's no other options at that point. In a dominator culture, we just jump to that as like the first way. It's a strong arm people. So I don't even know if I answered your question.
There may not be an answer. I think it's the, I think we all struggle with it. We want to get people to understand things that we can't get them to even understand. We won't accept even talking about it.
Right. Right. Yes. Right.
By us individually choosing to live that within our own family system,
right,
we're modeling that.
Right.
So people don't even know what there's no, like, gosh, marriage is so hard. Actually, it doesn't have to be. You know, like, being a mom is so hard. It doesn't have to be. So we're offering an alternative when we are making a change ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Just modeling how that could be.
Yeah.
This presentation, by the way, has been a great model of moving from the ladder model to the field, right?
Yep. Yeah, I love it. Yeah, we're embodying this right now. Yes.
Anxiety, mm-hmm. The only way to really grow is to grow your
Right. And all of our other relationships. But think about if you approach someone who's in the dominator mode and you don't play that game, it's hard to, like, for them to rank if you're not playing that same game. It's, you know, if someone comes up and is, like, you know, chewing you out and you're like, you know, why, you're really upset. Tell me more about that. Like, they're going to be like, what? You know, they're expecting a fight. It's disarming, at least interpersonally. When you're talking about large power structures, that's a different thing. But that interaction can transform someone, right? It highlights, wow, I'm like this, and you're not responding in a dominator way.
That could be a husband and wife.
Could be a husband and wife.
Or a child.
A teacher, you know, or a boss, coworker. Was there a comment over here? Yeah, Gina. Yeah. Yeah. To play a different game. Right. Right. Great. Great point. Yeah. And I feel like that is our responsibility, and approaching that in a partnership. That's not blaming. See, that's where we tend to just go into, like, being, becoming dominators, right? Like, especially when we've been hurt or we've been wronged. So I think the trick is how to do that in a partnership way. And then, you know, sometimes fear can be, you know, a last resort. But thank you for that. Thank you. Yes. You're like, okay, moving around. All right, let's see. What is it? Oh, well, we have, we are seeing a little bit more of, in actual conference talks. This was from Sister Oscarson, 2005 April conference. Do we teach our sons and daughters there is no greater honor, no more elevated title, and no more important role in this life than that of mother or father? And then she also says, it's the term homemaker. All of us, women, men, youth, and children, single or married, can work at being homemakers. We should make our homes places of order, refuge, holiness, and safety. That's partnership right there, right? We care for each other. We're in this together. No, it's not women over here, men over here. We all take care of each other. Okay, ready? Oh, shoot, it's not that. But this is a good one. Scott Coltrane says, I think this is so important, societies with fathers who are physically close to their children, who care for them on a routine basis and are warm and affectionate toward them, we're the most likely to have both male and female gods. So this ties into the importance of balancing on every level. But I thought that was so interesting that that is tied to societies that have male and female gods. And we have the theology of that, but we're not embodying it and owning it, but it's there, like, it's there, which is really exciting. Let's see here. Okay. Woo-hoo. Collaborative roles and rules. Okay. So this is fluidity in gender expectations. So what that is like, it's not, I'm not saying erase gender. I don't know why everybody's so afraid of that. Like, you can't, like, if it's eternal, it can't be erased, so don't worry about it. Fluidity in gender expectations. So there's not rigid, like, this is what, you know, boys play with knives and guns, and don't you dare touch a doll, because that mean, you know, a child can just kind of grow and be exposed to different things and express themselves, and it's not rigid. Moving from roles, this was kind of a parent win. I got to share this. I have a 13-year-old son. When he was 11, he inherited his older brother's like queen-size bed. He was so happy. And the only bedding we had for that was this blue and green like floral print. So, you know, I said, hey, Owen, all we have is this floral bedspread. You know, if you want to look for something next week, we can go do that. And he said, oh, that's okay, Mom. I like this one. I like this. It's so comfy. I'm comfortable with my manhood. He says, I knit, I sing, I sew, I play football, lacrosse. Like, I'm good. See, he still has that. Like, 2 years later, he still has the floral paste. You know, I was like, yes. It was just a little parent win. Okay, moving from roles to rules. So this points to process and co-creation of the relationship instead of prescribed. We kind of talked about this before. So when we enter into a relationship, we immediately are sending messages about the rules of that relationship. Who's going to do what? And we cannot not communicate. So everything we do is communicating about that interaction. And then expansion of acceptable behaviors for males and females. So this is really about loosening up and letting people have a more leeway in how they express themselves in and gender in their relationships. In systems, in human systems, in family systems, integration is a sign of health. Integration. That's like good mental health is integration. Like, okay, I've integrated my story. It makes sense. I can integrate my emotions. I can hold seemingly, I can be angry at someone and still love them, even though those feel like they can't happen at the same time. So with this model, partnership is integration of men and women in all different parts of life. Now, that doesn't mean there's no distinction between them, but it means there's a lot more fluidity than maybe we had seen in our family of origin. Celebration of all contributions. So contributions of males and females in family life are celebrated. So I was teaching teaching this model to my team of therapists. And one of the therapists is like, all contributions? Like, really, all contributions? She's like, okay, so what about, you know, when you were having a really hard time with your teenager? You know, like, you want to celebrate that? And I was like, a good question. And I thought for a second, I said, yeah. You know what? That changed our family. That challenged some of our ways of being, and we are better for having gone through that, and I can celebrate that. I am a more compassionate person because I went through that experience. The fart jokes? No, I'm talking about like acting out. Oh, yeah, why not? Oh, I was like, wait, no, she didn't do fart jokes. But yeah, yes, humor. We celebrate humor. It doesn't mean no boundaries, but recognizing that everyone is a part of the system and contributing, even if it doesn't seem like it or feel like it at the moment. But every person is part of that process of growth. Yes. I like that. Can you give me, like, what would that look like if that were even, if the celebration, like, in terms of gender? I'm just curious your ideas.
One thing that comes to mind of a word that I've heard of, like, I don't know if this is true or not, but where a bishop recognized that the women didn't feel, at least young women, weren't feeling like they were being celebrated in the ward, and so he made it so he's like, there's no rules against them waiting at the door. Why does it always have to be the teachers or the deacons that greet people in from the door? So celebrate them by allowing them to have that privilege, or setting up the sacrament table versus just praying over it. Mm-hmm.
That example is the Newland McBain.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah, so I think what you're saying is challenge the cultural practices that are not grounded in doctrine at all. They just happen to be the way we do things, right? But challenge that. I was teaching a couple years ago the 9-year-olds, and I can't remember what the lesson was on, but one of them said, "Well, yeah, when you're this is a little boy. Yeah, when I'm 12, I get the priesthood, and the girls they get the beehive," and everybody's like, "What's that?" And I was like, whoop-de-doo. It just struck me as so true. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the only thing that kids can control is their effort towards something, right? There's pretty significant research that, like, praising, like, "Oh, you're so this, you're so that," is actually not helpful for kids. That praising effort makes a bigger difference, because that is what they can control. You can't always control if you're pretty, or, you know, you may have been born in a body that's not coordinated or athletic, but you can always control how much effort you put into it. So in my family, that's kind of, we talk a lot about that. Like, wow, you know, I great job practicing piano. I can tell you were really putting effort into working on the timing of that. Way to go. Like, I can tell that's important to you. So, I mean, it really takes work, even just to shift that and said, "Oh, you know, good job practicing, check," right? To see the invisible is really hard. Like, relationships, emotions, but really that's what partnership is. It's about that interconnection. 10 more minutes and for the whole thing? Oh, okay, I was like... All right, yeah, okay. Total for the whole thing. Okay, I just want to make sure I'm... Okay, compassionate communication. Development of peaceful communication skills. So a lot of us were raised in homes that use dominator communication, right? Don't cry or I'll give you a reason to cry. Thanks, Mom. No, just kidding. That was Dad. Oh, sorry. Okay, blame him. You know, wait till your father get, like, using fear to motivate. Well, it works in the short term, but physical punishment does not work in the long term. In fact, it's associated with a lot of mental health problems throughout life. So development of peaceful communication skills. There is a model called nonviolent communication, NVC, that is, I think, a really great model. So seeking nonviolent conflict resolution. And then compassionate communication also includes with yourself. And I've noticed that my Mormon clients are particularly hard on themselves. Right? And feel guilty for things. And I think we're the only church that feels guilty for things we haven't done. Right? Like, because there's always a million things we haven't done. So the practice of self-compassion, researcher Kristen Neff operationalized self-compassion and has done extensive research. And she identified three components of self-compassion, and I think they're really worth noting. The first is common humanity. And that is the recognition that our suffering is the thing that we all have in common. And when we're in pain, we want to withdraw. But to recognize that is part of the linking. That is how we're connected. No matter where you live, who you are, we have all experienced suffering. And so to recognize that your suffering is not individual, that you're not alone in that. The next one is mindfulness. And we're not very good at this either in Mormon culture. But that is being aware of your experience, paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally. So it's kind of curious. Wow, look, you know, I'm feeling kind of anxious, or I'm feeling more nervous about this presentation than I usually do. What? Huh. And, right? Just noticing without judgment. But we do the shoulds. I shouldn't be feeling this way, or I shouldn't resent my husband, or I shouldn't, you know, wish I'd never had children or whatever. And just, instead of just noticing our thoughts and our feelings and going, letting that teach us and then moving forward. So mindfulness. And then the third is self-kindness. And that is treating ourselves with kindness when we're suffering. Treating ourselves as we would treat someone else who is suffering. We often don't do that for ourselves. And when someone is suffering, what do you do? What are you compelled to do when you know someone's suffering? Touch them, right? We help regulate each other's physiological responses and emotions through eye contact, through touch. And we can actually calm ourselves down through touch. And in our culture, that's not appropriate. Like, we're not going to walk around, you know. But really, I have done that at times when I'm really worried about something. I'll just say, you know what? Of course you're worried about that. That's a big deal. Yeah, that hurt, you know. And I'll kind of do what I would do to my child. And it works. Another point on self-compassion is Kristen Neff says that her thesis is that psychology had fallen in love with self-esteem, and self-esteem is a cognitive evaluation of a part of your performance or life or being. And she says the great thing about self-compassion is it's always in your control. It's how you respond, not how you evaluate yourself. And on any given day, our performance or our appearance or whatever goes up and down, but we always are in control of how we respond to our own suffering. And I just really have loved that theory and found it really helpful, particularly with LDS, in my work with LDS women. So I, whoops. Sorry. Let's see what's going on here. Okay, here we are. All right. So this is just a quick practical tool that I still use. I learned it as an undergrad here like 25, 30 years ago in a communications class, but I still use it. So a tool for compassionate communication. I feel blank. You're feeling. So actual feeling, like happy, mad, sad, scared, surprised, disgusted, shame, whatever. When you, the other person's specific behavior, specific, not you always, you never. It's not specific if it has always or never. You never pick up your call. You know, you're always late to work. Whatever it is, because I think blank. And it's so simple, but it's really harder to do than it looks. So I feel, anybody want to do this? Just take a stab at it? Yeah, it can be used for good feelings or uncomfortable feelings. Oh, it's hard, I told you.
I feel frustrated when you don't do the dishes during the day because I think that you feel like you're a privileged member of the family who doesn't need to contribute to the upkeep of the house.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. I feel frustrated when you don't do the dishes during the day because I think that you think you're above, you know, taking care of things. Or in my version of that, it would be, I think you don't value me. Well, yeah, it's the same thing for me. So I feel, and I always joke, because frustrated is the Mormon woman word for mad, because we can't say mad. So it's just funny that I'm just laughing that you picked that word because it's like, oh no, I'm not mad. I'm just frustrated. Okay. All right. If it makes you feel better. What was that? Furious? Oh, that's right. We can say that. And then this phrase for making requests, it would mean a lot to me if. And one of the blessings/curses of being a therapist is my kids use this. Mom, it would mean a lot to me if we could go to the mall today to get my back to school clothes. Right? And it's like, it's hard to say no. And it's like, oh, well, let me think if I can make it happen instead of like, well, Mom, you said we can do that. Right? So that's my go-to phrase. It would mean a lot to me if. So just a little practical tool there. This is a big one, conscious language use. Word choices that reflect awareness of diversity and inclusion. Words create. They're how we understand things and how we frame things. So, for example, you know, being aware of you know, always defaulting to the masculine word for something. I'm trying to think of an example. Right. Oh, that one? Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, it's implied. Right. No, I'm not saying that it's right. Man is that, right? People, humans, are that they might have joy. Living things are that they might have joy. But being aware of that, and we perpetuate some of the dominator language in how we talk to each other, the words we use, sarcasm. And it's easy because, you know, words that my grandparents grew up with, like, I have a physical reaction when I hear, but it was normal for them, and it kind of keeps changing. And so really watching in your families, rooting out those words that are dismissive of particularly minority groups who have been disenfranchised, like being aware that that's not funny, that language matters. Language that includes shared responsibility for caring. So, my husband's babysitting for me tonight. No, right? Oh, honey, thank you for doing the dishes for me. Oh, so what my husband and I do is for our... Oh, thank you so much for mowing the lawn for our family. We say for our family with, because it's not for me. It's like, this is our family farm. We all contribute. Thanks for doing that for our family. And a lot of the language with gender has to do with the caregiving aspect. That, you know, it's expected that women will care. I was just talking about this at lunch. The default expectation that, oh, right here, that men don't have to think about who's going to take care of their children, right? But then if men care for their children, it's like, let's throw a big party. Like, oh, you're so lucky. Really? He's lucky. He's lucky too. Like, we're all lucky, right? That it's caring for human beings. And that's our work as men and women. Yes?
It reminds me, in our ward, the bishop thanked his counselor for sitting in the back with the children because his wife was speaking on the program.
Thank you for sitting in the back with your own children so your wife could speak.
He made a point of it.
Yeah. Can you imagine? You know, thank you for sitting, like acknowledging a woman for taking care of her kids. Like, right. 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 It's just, you know, and that's a dominator. We recognize certain things, we dismiss other things. Circularity and complexity are acknowledged and embraced. So that's moving from kind of a linear way of thinking to circular, and using language that is not reductionistic. I talked about this in my morning talk, but we've inherited a way of thinking that's reductionistic, dualistic, simplistic, and we just want to simplify everything and break it apart. But recognizing, you know, being able to say, I don't know, or that is really hard, and not have the answers. Like, letting ambiguity be okay in family life, and we're horrible at that in Mormonism, right? We know. The end. The end. Each word creates something else from which it is being distinguished. Language is our epistemological knife. It divides up our world into chunks for the purposes of knowing about them. Immersed in the flow of language, we don't realize that we create the similarities and differences, and we relate to those similarities and differences as if they were not made by us. Objects, events, and issues appear as we name them. And I think that's speaks to the importance of naming Heavenly Mother, Heavenly Parents, of if it has a name, it exists, it unfolds before us, if we can speak it. Words have the power to create, literally. Jacob 4:9, for behold, by the power of his word, man came upon the face of the earth, which earth was created by the power of his word. Somehow we are going to learn how to speak, to use our words that powerfully, and they are still powerful. I mean, that's a whole different level, but our words matter. The words that we say, how we refer to other people, how we talk about, how we frame, that's how we frame things. It represents how we think. And being very aware of that, I think, is a huge part of moving toward partnership. Watching for dominator language, anything that's having to do with ranking, pitting your, you know, oh well, you're the this, you know, you're the pretty child and you're the smart one, right? That's ranking. That doesn't help anybody. Yes.
What would you
I'm always one, like, if you don't say something, then nothing can change, right? And I think, again, if you approach it in a partnership and not shaming, like, how dare, I can't believe you diminished the work of, right? But if you're like, hey, I noticed something, and, you know, this doesn't go the other way, and I'm just curious if you're aware of that, because I noticed that, and I felt this. Great, great question. Okay, and the eighth C is creation and collection of partnership stories. So we have to be conscious about this, because most of our scripture and our myths and stories are dominator stories. And we have to actively search out new stories that are inclusive of female deity, that are have themes of connection. Unfortunately, many of the stories we inherited from earlier times teach that dominating or being dominated are the only alternatives. That there are today stories offering a partnership alternative of relations built on mutual benefit, mutual respect, and mutual accountability is a sign of a major revolution in consciousness. We need a concerted effort through the arts, music, and literature, as well as through science, to show that a partnership way of structuring human society is a viable possibility. We need the new language for describing societies offered by the partnership system and domination system. This was one, just an example of a book that I sought out, and we did Family Home Evening based on each of the females that were highlighted in the story of courageous women from the Bible. Because you have to actually work hard to find them. And so a consciousness of that is really, really important. And not just, you know, we kind of think of, well, our girls need to know, our boys need to know that women are prophetesses and led armies and held positions in government. It's really important for all of us to be able to see that. And I created this this meme last year. I do a lot of social media stuff, but this is one story that can easily be changed. We are daughters of heavenly parents who love us, and we love them. That's a quick fix. And I think that's a great place to end, because partnership is about valuing every contribution equally. It's about men and women working side by side with the same goals, and it's not about valuing one over the other. And I think this model has so much to teach us about how we can create Zion, how we can create something like those periods of peace in the scriptures, where there was no one elevating themselves above another and there were no poor among them, because that vision is beautiful to me, and I want to move us toward that, and I hope you will too, and I hope that this, I feel like I'm going to bear my testimony. I'm not. And I hope that something in this will spark, in this presentation will spark a change, because there is no us and them. It's just us. The culture is in us. We are in the culture. The brethren are in us. We are in the brethren. You're in me. We're in this together. It's not a us versus them. And I think that opens up exciting possibilities. Thank you.